TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Helen Caldicott on 9/11. Hope in the Age of Terrorism. Recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco on 9/11/2002. Helen Caldicott was introduced by fellow physician and friend, Dr. Joseph Keon.
Tonight, we have one of the world's truly great leaders here with us. She is a woman who is trained as a physician and has practiced preventive medicine on a global scale for 3 decades. She's devoted her life to the cause of humanity. She is a Nobel Peace Prize nominee. She has authored 5 books. She is the subject of an Academy Award-winning film. She has received honorary degrees from 19 different universities. She has been awarded the Gandhi Peace Prize, the John Rogers Foundation Award for Integrity, which incidentally she shared with Bishop Desmond Tutu, and the Elizabeth Blackwell Award, which is given by the American Medical Women's Association. Dr. Helen Caldicott's tenacity and passion for healing this world is simply unmatched. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Helen Caldicott is now taking the stage. The lights go down and she's lighting a candle.
This candle stands for all the people who were killed last year. It stands for the 5,000 people who were killed in Afghanistan. In fact, it stands for all the people that have been killed in wars. Millions. And I hope it doesn't stand for people in Iraq who at this moment are feeding their babies, bathing them, and lying beside them as they go to sleep, feeling that incredible joy that a mother or a father or a grandmother has lying next to their baby. Or they've just finished making love and they're lying next to their lover, falling into this deep and blissful sleep. Will, in a few weeks, those people be murdered by slices of metal cutting through their bodies, producing body parts? You see, for the first time in 3 million years, we must evolve and we must stop killing. We must settle our disputes, and there will always be disputes, by conflict resolution and discussion, for after every war, even between Palestine and Israel, people sit down and say, okay, we've killed enough, there's enough blood all over the place, now we'll work it out. If we don't do that, and I'll describe in more intimate detail why, with the world laced with nuclear weapons, within the next 10 or 20 years, we're going to destroy the only life in the universe. So now is the turning point in the history of our evolution, and we're only 3 million years old, so we're a very young species, embryonic almost. We must evolve very rapidly, even within the next month or two. I want to set the tone tonight by reading 2 Shakespearean sonnets, and they're about love. All of us are capable of great love, even those who do awful things and go to war. Jesus talked about love 2,000 years ago, the greatest psychiatrist who ever lived. And we've preferred to ignore what he said. Doesn't matter if you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, he was one of the greatest prophets. He said, love thine enemies, He said, do good to those who hate you. Difficult, a very big psychological workout, but possible. And underneath this is love for every human soul, however you see them. All beautiful. And on their deathbeds, people haven't lived very good lives, recant, and their soul opens up like a perfect rosebud. And that's in all of us. And that's what we must tap into if we are to survive. And that must become the ethic of today, next week, next year, and for the rest of time. This is the 18th sonnet. And think about those you love as I read it. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed. And every fair from fair sometime declines by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. This is the 116th sonnet, and it applies not just to individual people, but to countries in the world, and there are 190 nations now on the planet. Each one as precious and as individualistic as the other. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it's an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Now, unfortunately, I have to get into some of the tougher stuff. For, as your wonderful President Jefferson said once, prophetically, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. This democracy recently has been ill-informed. It is run and informed by corporate media who are interested in profits, no matter what, and we've seen that recently on Wall Street with Enron and the like. It is true, I think, that the media should not be privately owned. It should be like the BBC or the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, publicly owned with an individual charter that it can do what it needs to do journalistically to educate the people, because the media is determining the fate of the earth. Today in the New York Times, there's an article on page 20, and it's titled On the Job and at Home, Influential Hawks, 30-Year Friendship Evolves, and these are the people that are running this country. Colin Powell is not. He's been marginalised. The State Department has no say at all. These are the people determining foreign policy. We won't mention the president. The first one is Dick Cheney, who gives the major speeches, and he gave a long speech the other day about why it is necessary to go into Iraq, and I'll discuss that in a minute. He's 62. He's had several major heart attacks. He started off working for Richard Nixon in 1969. He's been a member of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a right-wing think tank like the Heritage Foundation, the chairman and CEO of Halliburton Company, which is currently being investigated for fraud, as is Cheney. He malappropriated or misappropriated $100 million, And I think maybe one of the reasons he's so hasty in going to Iraq is that it will take attention off him. The next one is Donald Rumsfeld, who's 70, who is a friend way back of Dick Cheney. They worked together. He was called by Henry Kissinger the most ruthless man he ever knew, including global potentates. What happened was when he was Secretary of Defense for Ford, Kissinger was Secretary of State, and he was in Moscow negotiating, I think, SALT II. Rumsfeld doesn't believe in any arms control treaties at all. Incidentally, he's one of the architects of the five-layered Star Wars system, missile defense system. And while he was away, Kissinger, Rumsfeld called together the National Security Council and brought in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they scuttled SALT II in Kissinger's absence. Ford was furious, absolutely furious, but it was too late, it was done. That's Rumsfeld. Now, who works with Rumsfeld and who really organises Rumsfeld is a man called Paul Wolfowitz, who's 58. He is an absolute hawk. I don't know what happened to him when he was younger, but something happened to him. He's extremely intelligent, very smooth. And the day after September 11th last year, September the 12th, when there was a single plane in US airspace riding around picking up 20 members of the bin Laden family to take them back to Saudi Arabia, he was talking about going to Iraq on September the 12th last year. This is an excellent article. And last but not least is a man called Lewis Libby, who's called Scooter. And Scooter is Dick Cheney's main advisor. And they all work together very comfortably. They socialise a little. They go to each other's weddings or whatever. But they are running the whole show. Condoleezza Rice is a little bit marginalised now, but Bush likes to have her beside him. And if ever there's a problem, he always says, "Where's Condi?" So it's imperative that you all read this article today. It will tell you a lot about how the country is operating and who's operating it. When I wrote this book 2 years ago, it was I knew it was very important, and it is about these characters and many more. And it was under contract with Simon & Schuster, and I sent in the manuscript in January 2001, and they, within 5 weeks, said it wasn't good enough, the paragraphs weren't right, the commas were in the wrong places, and they rejected the contract, rejected the manuscript, and asked for the money back. I was devastated because I knew this was a very important book. Then we found another great press called The New Press, and it got published. However, it was written before September 11th, so I did an update, the prologue, after September 11th, and changed a few things. But day by day, it becomes more relevant because I talk about Iraq in the book. The problem now with the world is that the Cold War didn't end. We all thought it did. We were exhausted by working so hard, the churches and the doctors and the lawyers and the merchants and the chiefs and the undertakers. I mean, I was asked to go and address a national conference of the Mortician Society in America, and I said, "Well, why do you want me to talk to you?" And they said, "Well, we don't want to have to embalm radioactive bodies." And I said, "Well, don't worry, because you'll probably be one yourself, you see, but..." The whole country, you remember, stratified, like planes stratify in the air, and everyone got involved with their own professional group and their churches, their gardening clubs and the like. And in 5 years, from most people in 78 supporting the concept of better dead than red, 80% of people said we won't have a nuclear war because it's bad for our health. I'm being semi-facetious. One of the most important conferences, I think, that was held in this country was held in the Herbst Lecture Theatre here, where the United Nations Treaty was signed. And out there is a portrait of the people who signed it, and a man from my country called Doc Evatt is in that portrait, one of our greatest states persons. He was the Deputy Prime Minister. So Physicians for Social Responsibility held a symposium here on the medical consequences of nuclear war, and we had George Kistiakowski, who was a chemist in the Manhattan Project. We had Howard Hyatt, who was the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. And the thing went on for 2 days, talking about how you make a nuclear weapon, how they explode, what happens if a bomb drops on the Herbst Lecture Theatre. My friend B came for 1 day and was so distraught, got such a splitting migraine she couldn't come the next day. From that symposium was made a film called The Last Epidemic, which was shown literally hundreds of thousands of times throughout the United States and turned people upside down on the on the concept of nuclear war. Now, because of the work we all did and throughout the world and Gorbachev, the Berlin Wall came down and communism collapsed. It was nothing to do with Russia being outspent, as the hawks would say. It was because Gorbachev heard doctors talk on National Soviet TV about the medical effects of nuclear war. His mother was a Christian, incidentally, and he was so extremely, profoundly affected by that. And how do I know? I attended a women's conference in Moscow. There were 5,000 women from all over the world, women with African butterfly headdresses, women from Peru in their top hats. Gorbachev was the only man in the room. And you've seen this often, it's in the Kremlin, the sort of presidium, big, red, huge hall, and up on the platform was Gorbachev and Raisa, and an Australian woman who helped organise it, and Petra Kelly, who died in Germany, who was sort of my sister, who helped to found the Greens. And they're all up in the podium, and at a certain point in the proceedings, and we were talking about nuclear war, two children, a Russian and an American, came down the aisle with this incredible Russian folk music, all the way down the aisle, and up on the platform, and handed Gorbachev a crystal globe of the world. And he took it from the children, and I watched him. He turned away, got his handkerchief out, and wiped his eyes. He was weeping. And the seat of his soul was the fact that he knew we could destroy life on the planet. So the Berlin Wall came down. Communism collapsed. But what happened then? Well, George Bush the first got in, and he actually unilaterally removed a lot of nuclear weapons. He said he needed to help Gorbachev combat his combative military. Then Clinton was elected. Clinton, who had never been to Vietnam, not that any of these people I just showed you have been to Vietnam anyway, and he smoked some dope. You know, he didn't inhale, but he smoked some dope. And he never felt he had the cojones, really, to take on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So he, after the Cold War ended, he set up a nuclear posture review, and he said to Les Aspin, Senator Aspin, you chair it. And Aspin said, and I recount this in this book, from a wonderful book called by Jan Nolan, The Elusive Consensus. And Aspin said, we don't need nuclear weapons anymore. Russia's friendly. Let's get rid of them. Let's abolish them, which is what we all thought they were going to do. Well, Aspin then died, very inconveniently. And a young man called Ashton Carter, an altruistic, wonderful young man, blonde hair, took over, and the Joint Chiefs ate him for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And at the end, they said they called ash to the carpet and destroyed him, and the nuclear posture review. So at the end of it, the missiles and the weapons were still in place, even though Russia and America are best friends. America still had and has a policy to fight and win a nuclear war against Russia. How do you do that? You knock out their satellites, blind them, knock out the command and control center, have your 18 Trident submarines with many weapons on them, and the Minutemen 3 and the MXs that Reagan called peacekeepers, and you launch your first strike, terribly accurate these weapons are, that land on top of their missile silos, and they can't press their button because they're dead, because Moscow's been taken out, and you kill their missiles. Millions of people dying is called by the Pentagon collateral damage, and that's still the policy of the United States. At the end of the nuclear posture review, the weapons were all still in place, and of course Russia kept hers because that's the only reason she has any power, because she's got nuclear weapons. And one general said at the end of this, he said, if you threaten our missiles and our early warning system, he said, baby, you're threatening the family jewels. Now I want you to think about that concept and that statement from a psychological perspective. It's very, very profound, and it comes from the reptilian midbrain. And in medicine, unless we find the cause or etiology of a disease, we can't cure it. We found the poliovirus, Jonas Salk did. We developed a vaccine, and now none of us get polio, infantile paralysis. The etiology of the nuclear arms race and the risk that the planet is in now is the mind of these men. And we've got to start looking at it and have the courage to say, now, you're inappropriate to be in this position. Rumsfeld, you're not appropriate to be there, so we're removing you for the public health of the people of the planet.
Dick Cheney, he probably needs some medical care anyway, so he could be removed as well, and we'll decide who we put in and not the corporations. Let me read you a lovely thing I got. Rumsfeld has what the press call a bizarre style of English language dubbed rummy speak. And there were media people gathered at Brussels recently at a news conference addressed by Rummy, and he said this: "The message is that there are no knowns. There are things that we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns, things we do not know we don't know. So when we do the best we can and we pull all this information together and we then say, well, that's basically what we see as a situation, that is really only the known knowns and the known unknowns. And each year, we discover a few more of those unknown unknowns." Rumsfeld, seeing the apparent bewilderment on the faces of the scribes, offered a summary of what he said. "There's another way to phrase that, and that is that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence." That's the man determining much of the foreign policy of the United States of America. So I go into at length the thinking of the military, and like in football, much of the language is sexual. And they talk this language, like missile erectors and soft laydowns and deep penetrations, without any embarrassment in front of women like me and Randy Forsberg, you know, and they haven't even the consciousness to understand that their reptilian midbrain is active. Their right brain isn't working at all, and their left brain is being used to justify what the reptilian midbrain tells them to do. Now, in this book, I talk about who runs this administration. 32 members of the administration, high levels in the cabinet, come from the military-industrial complex. Lockheed Martin occupies 28 seats. The rest come from the Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank, which spends $29 million a year on the media. So every time you turn on Jim Lehrer, who's very respectful to them, there's the Heritage Foundation fellow talking very smooth, very articulate and intelligent, but their basic concepts, shall I say, are wicked. They sound good, though. They're funded by Lockheed Martin, Hertz Rent-A-Car, Holiday Inns, Coors Beer, Ocean Spray, Cranberries, Reader's Digest, and the like. They are an advertising company for the corporations who want to build all these weapons. But who else is defining the White House? Let's just go through this. Andrew Card, who's Bush's chief of staff, moved to the White House from a posting as General Motors vice president. Paul O'Neill was chair of Alcoa. Bush crony Don Evans, the Commerce Department secretary designate, is CEO of Tom Brown, Inc., an oil company. Donald Rumsfeld is former CEO of G.D. Searle and of General Instrument, and held a variety of other top corporate posts. Anthony Principe is president of a wireless telecommunications company. National Security Counsel Condoleezza Rice is a member of the board of directors of Chevron, which has christened an oil tanker, the Condoleezza Rice. Charles Schwab is a member of J.P. Morgan's International Advisory Council. The transition team for the Department of Energy, this is a little old, this article, is almost exclusively made up of people affiliated with or working with the extractive energy industry. Companies and outfits represented include Phillips Petroleum, Enron, Kennecott, Southern California and Edison, the National Mining Association and the Nuclear Energy Institute. For the Department of Health and Human Services transition, the drug, biotech, insurance and hospital industries had their way. The transition team included representatives from Merck, American Hospital Association, Mutual of Omaha, Bio, Ernst & Young and the Association of Health Underwriters. Department of Labor transition team, they came from Union Pacific, National Restaurant Association, American Trucking Association, National Mining Association, U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Society of Human Resource Managers. So do you have a democracy? No. Who wrote the energy policy? And Cheney, who I'm sure is scientifically illiterate, A survey was done in Canada, and it found that only 3% of politicians were scientifically literate. Many of them come from the business sector, as we know, and the rest are lawyers. So without people really understanding what's going on, Cheney's decided to build about 477 new nuclear power plants because it's clean. They're clean. They're clean energy. They don't cause global warming. I'll just deviate a little from my talk to say that you have to operate a nuclear power plant for 18 years before you get one net calorie of energy because of the huge amount of fossil fuel that's used to mine the uranium, then to enrich it. America had 7 1,000-megawatt coal-fired plants enriching its uranium in the 70s, pouring out CO2. Then you've got to build this huge monstrosity. It can only operate for 30 years before it has to be shut down. Then you've got to transport the nuclear waste and store it for 500,000 years. So it adds enormously to global warming and to random compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk by Helen Caldicott, held on the anniversary of 9/11 in the Herbst Theater in San Francisco in 2002. My apologies for interrupting it here. This is all that fits into TUC Radio's half-hour slot. But you're getting a sense of the new direction Helen Caldicott is taking in her anti-nuclear work. After finishing her most recent book, The New Nuclear Danger, she has returned to the U.S. from her home in Australia. She will dedicate the next 5 years of her life to a new round of anti-nuclear campaigns. As you will hear in the next program, she addresses how nuclear weapons have already been used in the form of depleted uranium. She also talks about the enormous legacy of nuclear waste and the new U.S. program to place nuclear weapons in space. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Helen Caldicott on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. Helen Caldicott's new organization, the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, can be reached at www.nuclearpolicy.org. That's nuclearpolicy.org. You can get a copy of the full one-hour speech by Helen Caldicott by calling us. The audio tape is $12. A transcript is $10. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.